Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And today's guest is someone you may know in life anyway, and you may have met him here on Love Letters Live, is Rabbi Peretz Mochkin, who is the Chabad Rabbi of North Beach in San Francisco. And such an interesting man, has a lot to say, and is so much fun to listen to. So I'm just going to kind of go right to you. Do you want to say a little bit about what Chabad is, or we don't even need to do that?
Well, Chabad, I may as well. We just came back from a Chabad conference.
Okay.
And I have a friend who I grew up with who is not a Chabad rabbi, but he wrote an article in this week's Forbes that spoke about the ultimate entrepreneur. The ultimate entrepreneur was the Chabad Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, of blessed memory. And Rabbi Schneerson had the same conundrum every great entrepreneur has, and that, how do I clone myself? How do I get other people to help me with my work? And he had an ambitious work. His dream was to make this world a kinder and better place. And the way to do that would be to reach out to every one of our brothers and sisters and the Jewish people and inspire the world to reach out to all of their family and all their connections to really connect and be one with one another. And the article highlighted how the Rebbe accomplished that, and he was able to create 5,000 clones out there all over the world.
A.K.A. franchises.
A.K.A. franchises, right. Over the globe doing this work. And it was quite exciting to be at the conference and see so many like-minded people who are out there trying their best and just to affect the world a little more in a positive way.
You do so much of that. And we were just talking a minute ago about what you were doing to bring people together in one of the programs you have with highlighting entrepreneurs. And I forget exactly what you said, but you ended it with, and then we were just ready to rock and roll.
And
that is so you.
Well, this is an exciting time in the world. An entrepreneur basically is different than a businessman of old. You could have called anybody in any generation somebody who has ingenuity and is working on their life an entrepreneur. But today that title has taken a new kind of philosophical approach, and that is I am going out on my own with very high risks of failure. And one of the reasons why I think people will take that risk in today, maybe more than ever before, is because we've kind of left the role of the human survivalist, of being somebody who is just about surviving and making sure I have. We're leaving the part of the world that deals with my consumption, and we're starting to focus more on what do I bring to the table and what do I affect the world with and what am I about.
Okay, well, two things. You talked about willing to take the risks, but part of that is because if you don't fail, if you succeed, the rewards are so high.
Well, that may be the case that the reward is high, but people are putting their whole lives on the line, living in very extreme circumstances, you know. You don't need me to know the stories of people starting in garages and basements trying their best. And you could tell it's not just about the money. And I understand that all businesses are about the money. But in reality, today's entrepreneur is focused on the dream of really affecting the world. It's very heart-based.
Heart-based business. I just heard that the other day for the first time, I think. Heart-based businesses. Yes.
Well, anytime we think about a human being, it's hard to really put your finger on what the human being is outside of being a physical being that wants to eat and drink and, like we said, rock and roll and really, you know, enjoy their life. But in reality, at some point, they're confronted with things that are much bigger than their own personal consumption.
And what a wonderful segue into what we're going to talk about today, right?
That's where I'm getting to.
Okay, good. Because I noticed the other day, I saw a posting, actually, on Facebook that you were doing a seminar on the soul. And was it what happens to the soul after death? What was the specific?
I live in San Francisco. I'm in my ninth year, finishing up my ninth year here in the Bay Area. And even though I'm young, but one of the things you get in contact with as a rabbi is you deal with people who pass away and deal with the burials and the funerals. And being very young and being inexperienced in that field, it took a lot of research to figure out what would be the right thing for a rabbi to say. What would be the right thing to educate the people around you and what happens with life after death, etc. Oh, there's of course the misconceptions of hell and heaven and other things like that.
People ask, is there that?
Well, before we get to that
in Jewish life,
before we get to what there is or is not, it's interesting. In Judaism, there is a concept of heaven, but it's not what you may think. There is a concept of hell, but it's definitely not what there is in pop culture. there is a reincarnation, an afterlife, but that all is because you are really not a body. You are really a soul, and you have a physical experience.
A soul with a house.
A soul with a house, well, a vehicle, a vehicle. I kind of look at it like a filter. In one of the classes we were talking about this, we were talking about, look, think about your body as a filter. Anytime you meet anyone anywhere, you only bring a certain amount of yourself to the conversations, especially with people you're meeting for the first time. And you use pleasantries and hopefully, and other forms of connectivity with other people. And this preserves a part of yourself that you're just not ready to share with anyone all the time. And the more you get to know people, or the more you learn to harness yourself, you learn to bring it out to the forefront. It's part of growing in life. You learn where to place yourself. Product placement is a huge part of not only tolerance for the way you tolerate the world around you, but for how you feel about yourself. If people really put themselves in the right position, they would be more lovable.
Yeah,
so absolutely. When anybody's saying, "Oh, I have a hard time finding, you know, a soulmate or a connection," I say, "Well, you got to bring the best parts of yourself to the forefront in your dating life and in your career life, because that's the part people are attracted to." And I call that the soul part of your life.
Ah, the best part.
The best part. Well, the soul is the part of yourself that is not concerned with what you get, but with your mission on Earth and what you're here for in the first place.
Are you going to tell us what that is?
Ah, well, a little bit about soul.
Okay, please.
So let's talk about soul, and not necessarily the religious form, but in kind of the spiritual, mystical form. And the reason why I say not the religious form, because if everyone's got a soul, in other words, everyone's got a consciousness that can actually live without being concerned about what it gets, but about what it gives, and that's a large part of what makes the human being very different than other creations, then to a certain degree, the human being, by learning to experience that, that's really the soul experience that we're going to be talking about.
Okay, because you made a difference between the spiritual and the religious. Can you just, why?
I feel like when people hear religion, they're hearing a certain dogmatic approach to this is how it is. But I hope that people over time will learn to explain soul in their own words. And we need a better explanation of energy and soul. After all, we're really new to figuring out how to harness energy. You know, they always talk about what came first, the refrigerator or the energy. I believe it's chicken and egg. But
yes.
in reality, yeah, energy was always there. It was, mm-hmm, a matter of us learning how to harness it. Your soul is always there. You have a part of yourself that is greater than any of your physical challenges. And the beauty of that is that it has nothing to do with any religious semblance whatsoever. It is who you are. In fact, oftentimes religion gets in the way of that. It makes people feel like, oh, I have to follow a certain amount of rules, mm-hmm, to experience that. So that's why I'd like to have this discussion independent of a religious element, even though I am a religious guy, because by you finding more soul in your life, I think so many other things in your life are going to be uplifted. You'll be able to have a better lens for and appreciate your journey. There is a major discussion in this world about the fear of mortality, the fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, Ernest Becker won a Nobel Prize for talking about the terror management syndrome, which was basically how people are driven by their fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
And he equates it so strong that he felt like he needed to replace Freud's id of the human capacity to propel itself for sexual reasons. For him, it was the fear of death or fear of mortality.
Oh, as the overriding
reason motivator. Why people do so many, uh-huh, things in their life. And I'm not a big fan of the YOLOs, you only live once, and the idioms of...
Oh, I would see where you wouldn't be. Yes.
On the one hand, I am. You got to carpe diem, got to seize the day, you got to do the best you can, but it's been misinterpreted as, let's just have a good time because who knows what tomorrow is going to bring.
Uh-huh.
For me, I would love if the line was, let me maximize my potential because maybe this is the day I have to do that.
Oh, can you say that again slowly? So instead of you only live once, which you referred to as YOLO, I never heard of that.
You have today to maximize your potential.
You have today to maximize your potential.
I haven't made an acronym for that yet.
No, it's nicer in a whole thing.
Nicer the whole thing.
Yes.
One of the most famous people who actually used this fear of mortality to propel them to greatness was Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs. His speech, you can find on YouTube, to Stanford, was that he lived every day. He would tell himself first thing in the morning is that, what if today was my last day? And he'd go out there and maximize every moment of his time. This is independent of the character trait that we connect to. This is simply a motivator to get himself in position to maximize his unique gifts. Every person on earth has a unique gift. Mm-hmm. No two people are alike. And in order to bring that out, and in order to bring that amazing self that you have to the world, you have to live as if today is the most important day of your life. Time is probably the only non-fungible reality. You cannot replace 1 second with another. You can replace some things in life, but you definitely cannot replace time. And since a human being isn't replaceable, their partner in life is time. It's important to look at time not as something that I can't control and it just comes, but actually something to conquer. I started this course.
But I like
this,
what you said, to be a partner. Yes.
It is your partner. Yes, it is your clear. Own. It is your own utility. What is a partner if not? If you go on business on your own, oftentimes you feel destitute. You need somebody on your side, you know, picking up the slack and vice versa. So therefore, partners are always great. They bring different things to the table. Time is your partner. Instead of fear of aging, you look at it, the older I get something I cannot acquire with money. I get experience. And the world needs your experience. That's where your uniqueness lies.
Well, I took you a little off track. You were going to say more about that.
So I was getting to, like, I started off this course to talk about soul. I started with the discussion about time. Oh. And that if a person could learn to conquer time, what kind of person would they be? See, the human being have always focused on conquering space. Mm-hmm. How do we conquer the space of this world and buildings and incredible amounts of development in the physical? And now what are we learning? That we have to relearn how to conquer space. How do we do it that it's ecologically sustainable? How do we build this world in a way that fits the world in the program? It's not just about housing the human being. It's about using the world as a developmental tool to house the human being. There's so much we're learning now about the world. It doesn't have to be a global warming discussion. It has to be a sustainable discussion of what is my footprint as I go through this life. Am I just a consumer? Is that my whole existence? Where is my contribution? So we're relearning how to deal with the conquering of space. So time is something that people, well, you can't beat Father Time. Nobody's ever beaten that. Well, you're not supposed to beat time. Time, each moment, is its own creation. It's its own great moment. And every time you use it wisely, you've conquered it. You've made it real. You've made yourself real. You've validated all of existence through time more than space in this regard. So by taking that as an example, now we can think about soul. Soul is kind of your partner. You have your physical existence and you have your soul. Your soul would be the conscious part of yourself that really isn't concerned with consumption, kind of like it's not concerned with conquering space, but it is concerned entirely with conquering time.
What is in certain people, what is that part of you that is in some people concerned only with consumption and acquiring more?
When you're physical,
that's not their soul.
It's a natural instinct to want more. There's one of the great old lines of the Talmud that you don't need the Talmud for. This line is that when a person has one, they want two. When they have two, they want four. Why is that? So a lot of people interpret that as something evil, kind of connected to ego.
Oh, like greed.
Greed. But in reality, it's just an energy. It's an energy for more. That zest for more, if it's switched from space to time, then it means I want to, when I have some love, I want more love. When I do a good thing, I want to do more good things. When I have a moment that I fulfilled myself properly, I want more moments like that. That same energy.
Having one and wanting two can be a very much a positive.
Can be a very powerful tool to being somebody who's responsible for what happens to them in their life and takes that responsibility. I equate all of these ideas and energies to soul because the underlying distinction between body and soul is the soul being finite is merely about its consumption. I'm sorry. The body,
about being finite,
is all about its consumption. The soul being eternal and being an energy and understand, just like we brought up the analogy of the refrigerator, it needs to harness the energy. The body is harnessing the soul. The soul being eternal and energy that always exists concerned.
So the question would be, if the soul, the body is not eternal, the soul is eternal, then where is the split there? The body is gone. And then where does this eternal soul go? If it's
obviously
still here, right?
Now, a lot of people only ask that question when there's death. what happens to the person? What are we really dealing with? And I think a lot of people choose to be agnostic about that. They are hopeful for a beautiful ending, but they don't really know, so they'll keep it to the imagination. But Judaism, interestingly enough, has a distinct idea about what happens.
What's
and the
that?
First thing is, it goes back to being itself. It always existed. There was an energy before you entered into a body.
Oh, so we're talking pure energy here.
Pure
There's
energy.
There's no asking where does it go physically, because it's not physical.
It's not physical. Uh-huh. It's an energy thing. So we can split it up into two. One energy could be called the biological energy, which is the human being existing, having that energy that enlivens the individual. And the second energy that we could be talking about is the emotional energy, which is superfluous. You don't really need it to be alive. You don't need to really have emotional energy. But that emotional energy is what connects people one to the other, is what makes us one with the other people around us.
Oh, I see. Yeah, sure.
On a physical level, you meet somebody, there's no connection. But emotionally, there could be fireworks. This idea that the soul is split into levels is kind of what we start off with, filters. That you don't give your emotional self to every person you meet. You connect biologically. I exist, you exist, hopefully. But the next level would be the emotional level. And the truth is, the reason why we struggle with our emotions, if it's soul and that's who we are, our struggle is based on this idea that the first part of soul that we connect to is just biological, that we're alive. And since we have to use that as a portal to get to a deeper part of self, emotional self, it's always a work in progress. So you can have an amazing emotional experience with somebody, and then you have to restart the process once you start living together or building a life together, because you're going to constantly have to go through the biological stage.
Of presenting more of yourself.
Correct, in order to get to emotional self.
Each new day takes getting used to.
You're growing, right?
Yes.
So you're going to, and they're growing, hopefully. We're all growing, so therefore, just by virtue of time, like we're saying, you're growing, just by experience and development. So it's always going to take this kind of interface of getting from this biological self of that I exist, going to an emotional self of I exist for a reason. And that's a tremendous difference between I exist, whether I exist for a reason.
Soul. And you're getting back to that reason is to...
So having a soul means that I have a mission on earth.
Yes.
I'm here for a reason. I'm here to do something. And that is the big difference between having a God as the axiom for creation versus not having a God. If there's no God, then there's no reason you're here. You are merely an evolutionary product. And whether or not you define good and bad in your own personal terms really doesn't matter. It just matters that you live your life any way you want, really, and the best way you can in society, which is very limited. Because it really doesn't matter then whether you fulfill your life or not, whether you feel good about your life or not. It's merely whether society is burdened by you or not. I find that to be a very depressing way to live without God. I just find it, if you're really an atheist, then you struggle with my life is only whether or not I feel good. But that feeling is fleeting. Because
so you want to be connected with something larger than...
It's interesting. Yes. On the one hand, emotions is feeling, but at the same time, without a God behind your emotions... behind the axiom of why you existed, then your emotions have no purpose. They just get in the way. So it's pretty fascinating that as soon as you start talking about soul, you can't talk about soul without you having a unique mission on earth. There's no discussion that there could be soul without mission. There's no discussion that could be God without you being indispensable.
So what is this mission?
Well, hopefully,
that we have?
Hopefully you're working yourself individually on figuring out what your mission is. Just like any good business has a mission statement.
So your mission would be what you said before.
Well, each person has their mission. I think for me, it's clear that a big part of my mission is going out to a place that is not the same background as where I came up and focusing on not my background, but focusing on how I facilitate other people to grow in their life. But even with that said, as my children are getting older, I'm realizing that I'd rather be known as a good dad and a good husband and not a great rabbi than vice versa.
Yeah.
So maybe me living up to my potential
That's
here.
That's probably what will make you a great rabbi.
I think so.
Yes.
I think so. I realize very deeply that the better dad I am and the better husband I am.
I see you making muffins with your boys and
whatever it takes.
Cooking. And
I just made some sauerkraut and we're working on pickles now. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're trying. But this to me is a soul level. Any connection that is not about your consumption, because as soon as you hit into the emotional realm, it's not important. It's not vital to your existence, technically. Now we are talking about how important it is psychologically for people to be healthy. Even that discussion to me is a soul-like discussion. So let's take it to the Torah for a minute. The Torah is the Bible, coming from the five books of Moses. And when it talks about creation, it's really very anthropomorphic, right? That's where people will see God as like a being versus an energy, and people as a distinct evolution versus a mission. I've decided that anthropomorphism, making something physical, is merely inviting you into the discussion. It can't be that's what it is. It's like describing me as a person is not describing me. Describing me as somebody who is working on being good to other people around me is closer than he's a person. Mm-hmm. And we're all learning how to do that now, right? We're all learning how to, instead of signaling people out for a plain element, all in race and in hierarchy in society, we're learning that we have to describe people based on their value.
Yes.
And their true value is bigger than just the clothing that they're wearing and the body that they're using. So as we grow in these elements, and for me it's soul elements, I have no reason to feel otherwise. When you look in the Torah to the creation, this anthropomorphic creation, it's interesting that when it says the animals and the world was created, God said and it was created. But when it comes to the human being, it says there was a body created, and then it says, and he breathed into the body life. In other words, the body represents the vehicle, and the life was always there. It's about putting it in. So God as an energy starts being a much deeper discussion than God as somebody in charge of things.
Sure.
God of judgment. We are talking about God as an energy, meaning that we're all interconnected. And I think this world is the best it's ever been. I don't know why people are always like, there's so much bad in the world. And yeah, maybe, but we are in the best place we've ever been as human beings.
Okay, I'd like to know what you see, because there can be bad in the world and still we're in the best place.
I think so.
It can still be the best it's ever been, even though
it's a terrific place to be right now. I would never want to go back in history. Forget just the quality of life. Human beings really do. The majority of this world, it appears to be, really understand the limitations of race and the limitations of the disenfranchisement of who connects to who, and realize that the quality of the individual will always reign supreme. The person who puts their best foot forward and works harder.
So you're saying we're more aware than we've ever been.
We are more soul-like than we've ever been. That's
okay.
What that is.
Okay.
People would call people holy and think that it's a separatist term. There's a holy person. But we're all holy, because holy basically means when I live beyond my own consumption. That's what holiness
is. Okay, that's a lovely, lovely short way to say it.
It warms the conversation.
Yes, it
because
really does.
All conversations about God, soul, and energy should always be a majority inclusive of how people are unique.
Okay, so what part of you goes somewhere after death? The afterlife, the Olam Haba.
So now that we spoke about that there's a biological element and an emotional element, people ask me this. When the body passes away, what's unleashed is the emotional soul. And because that part is unleashed, that's why we feel a tremendous amount of, we just feel a tremendous amount, you know? We shouldn't say what yet. People have different feelings when there's death. But it's interesting, around the world, if you hear somewhere across the world somebody passes away, why does it affect us? It just does. If it's a child, wow, does it affect us?
Oh,
if it was
goodness.
A tragedy, it just,
oh,
you could think about it all day.
Even if you see a funeral procession,
It has nothing to do with you whatsoever.
Yes, you do.
And the reason it does is because it brings up the fear of mortality, the fear of how this world in 1 second everything could be gone.
Oh, I thought it was more because you are aware that you have, even though you don't know this person, there's an awareness that you have lost something.
No, that's a beautiful thing. I love that. Don't say no. It's wonderful.
I'm asking you. I mean, I always
you're more
that.
Refined than me in that sense. You know, that's the first thing. But in California, as you know, our fear of mortality, we try to cover all elements of life. I wonder if that's why I don't ever see any in this West Coast. I never see any like funeral processions as much. Like in the East Coast, I felt like I saw it more often. And, you know, if I was going from Brooklyn to Queens and going through the Jackie Robinson, there's cemeteries.
I don't feel like I see a lot of cemeteries here.
Sometimes
you see one going through Chinatown. You know, and it's I have seen a few of those.
Seasonal, right before the Chinese New Year's is when that happens.
When people die?
No, they actually like to preserve the bodies until Chinese New Year's. This was somebody telling me in North. I live in North Beach. I hear these things.
I never heard that. But you know, there's something about. It's just heart ripping. There's something about a funeral procession, and you know that people are having now to do without someone important.
Yeah.
Well, this is heart ripping.
So let's just dive into what Judaism says happens after somebody passes away, and then let's try to bring it back to introduction, this 20-minute introduction here will help us
get there.
So let's just go straight to that and then bring it back. So a person passes away, there's a 3-day stage, what we call the first 3 days. The soul is actually completely and utterly afraid. What does that mean? It means as follows. Let's say there's a soul. Okay, we're a soul. We're buying into this. At what point do you go from, I'm limited, I don't know why things are, I just exist, to, I see the big picture, I understand how everything fits in, I see how everything is providence and fits into the mastery of this world. When does that happen? Instantly? Person dies and they get it? Oh, it's beautiful. So sad that they miss me. What are we talking about? At what point does the soul get the big picture versus being limited to the consciousness we have now? So in our tradition, it turns out that it's not instant. It actually happens in 4 stages over a year-long time.
Oh.
Pretty amazing. First 3 days, the soul is actually with the body, wherever it is, and it's in real pain, wondering how come it can't continue creating and doing what it was supposed to do. It's not vibrant. How come it's alive, but the body is not? Something very, very painful. Then the second stage would be the 7-day period. And the 7-day period would be where it's going back and forth to the place it lived and seeing the people it's leaving behind and hopefully some good relationships. And it's struggling with the inability to connect with the people who left. And it's starting to take into picture that it is not part of the physical world anymore. Still very strenuous. Stage number 3 is the first 30-day period. We call the 30-day period the time for legacy, where you should start thinking about what kind of legacy to put on the person, what kind of charity to give in their honor, what to do.
Oh, for the living to do that.
Well, kind of, and why? It's connected to the 30 days. The soul is going through judgment. So I always thought, what do you mean judgment? There's some heavenly tribunal judging. And I heard once a wonderful Hasidic rabbi say, it's an old story, say, it's not heaven or God judging you. It's you judging yourself. Your life is being shown to you. You're given an opportunity to kind of, the slower version of my life flash before my eyes. It's we call the 30-day stretch.
Long and painful.
Yeah, like long and painful and really have to deal with. I mean, how would we confront our life, you know, in this manner? Pretty painful. And then we have the 12 months, which basically the 12 months is the stage of where the soul is learning what it means to be spiritual and be absorbed in its energy and is still conflicted back and forth with the humans it's leaving behind and the physicality it's leaving behind. And more importantly, by the end of this 12-month period, it ceases to see itself as a physical entity and is entirely absorbed in its state of consciousness, its emotional state of consciousness.
Is that why you don't set a headstone till 12 months?
So now you take this knowledge and you go, well, the Jewish idea of mourning is actually parallel to the stages of soul.
Oh, in intensity.
Pretty amazing. Correct.
To,
and intensity. Goodness. So the first 3 days, if you're not a really good friend or a family member, you're not supposed to really visit the bereaved, just the people's mourning, kind of let them be absorbed in it. Why would we let them be absorbed in it? Well, the pain they're feeling in the first 3 days is connected also to the soul's departure, also not being able to make sense of the departure. The first 7 days, we have something in our tradition called Shiva. Shiva just means 7, but it also is a play on the word sit, lashev, to sit.
Oh.
So what, the people are not supposed to go to work from a loved one, they're supposed to, for 7 days, just have guests over, have people over, and really just talk about the departed and try to talk about the best parts of the departed. And the first 30 days are part where we go back into the world after 7 days, but we observe still mourning, like we don't go to concerts and to weddings and we take the idea that I'm in mourning serious. And then we have the 12-month period where we do something called Kaddish. We say Kaddish, which talks about transcendence, where we're comforting the soul, saying, go to your eternal space and feel your original energy. It's really smart to have this paralleled experience. There are people who mourn for people way too long. And a large part is because instead of mourning right, getting it all out there in 3 days, and then 7 days like really zoning in about this loss, and 30 days thinking about the legacy and the good parts about the human being, and then 12 months thinking about transcendence and the nature of soul, how could we comfort the person who died, and how could the person who died, their energy comfort us if we're not being absorbed within this? But it's only after a year where on the anniversary of the person's passing, not only we don't mourn anymore, we celebrate their life. We switch to a day of joy, a day of celebration, where we live with the best parts of the energy that they affected our world. So I think it's remarkable that when you turn to soul as the primary element of human being, and by soul, I'm welcoming you calling it an energy, a consciousness, a divine element of existence. But when you live with that being the main element of human being, you're really living with someone who is eternal to you. In other words, that whether or not you are able to physically live up to your expectations, you connect with on a level that you're definitely consciously developing as a mission-oriented individual. You may look at your life and say, well, I haven't done a lot of good things. But I would disagree. I would say a human being alive, a body and a soul being on earth, if you're even thinking about this, you're already doing good things because you're already thinking about how do I live beyond just my consumption. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by the world's the best ever. There are more people thinking about this than ever before. There's no question that today, every individual in this country has at least once heard you could be anything you want. Mm-hmm. That's foreign terms to the history of mankind.
Yes.
It just is.
Yes.
And that is soul talk. And we should promote soul talk because it really isn't a religious element. It is a human-driven element towards being beyond my own survivalism. It's what drives us in all of our arts and culture, and it's what drives us in our connecting to human beings from around the world, and it's what drives the billions given to charity around the world today. It's unbelievable the amount of charity that people give, both in time and financial resources. It's pretty amazing. And this is why I think Judaism is important that this discussion needs to happen because it fuels the discussion in every culture. Mm-hmm. People say, well, in our culture, we have that too. And I go, awesome.
That's and great. Of course you do.
That's great. Yes. You know, we're not looking to be dominant. We're looking to inspire. Yeah. It's a huge difference. We're not a proselytizing culture. We're inspirational culture. It's a huge difference. So that would be the death element. And it's difficult. I've met people in this town who I met them and they said, I can't talk right now, I'm mourning. I was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, when did this person pass away? Mm-hmm. And one time this individual said it was like 7 years ago. And I felt like 7 years you're mourning, that's a long time to mourn.
Yes.
And I think it's unhealthy. Why is it unhealthy? Yes. Because you're not actually being true to the energy of the individual.
Oh.
They're not in pain anymore.
You know, I was at a, well, okay, a friend's mother died. Maybe you'll know this. I'm still looking. Mother died, and it was a very close family, and obviously there was a lot of pain, even though she was quite a bit, I mean, a very old woman who had lived a gorgeous, gorgeous, flawlessly beautiful life. Not a thing to regret. And yet, she was gone, and her daughter found on her bedside table a poem that said, I'm going to cry, "Don't mourn for me too long. Don't think of me too long." And it was the essence of it was, let me go. I have places to go. I can't be kept here by your sorrow.
Mm. Wow.
And it was a definite, and I've been looking for that poem now.
The key is mourn, but don't mourn too long.
Yes. And don't think of me don't think of me too long.
You have to
learn
to transfer from mourning to celebration.
Well, but also that whole, because you touched on that soul has places to be. It has to be set free. That was the thought.
It is set free.
Uh-huh.
And that is that, you know, there was this rabbi in the beginning of the 18th century who lived under Tsarist Russia and decided he wanted to make a pilgrimage to Israel. He wanted to live the rest of his life there. Granted, Israel was probably a more difficult life at the time than living under Tsarist Russia.
Yes.
Resources were very slim there, but he decided he wanted to go, and he led this incredible pilgrimage, and they went and they lived there. They lived in the town of Tiberias in northern Israel, and he passed away. When he passed away, his community felt like they lost more than just a leader, their mm-hmm. mentor. They mm-hmm. lost their father. They lost the real light. So they sent a letter back to Tsarist Russia to this man's colleague, which was the founder of the Chabad movement, mm-hmm. Reb Shneur Zalman, and he sent them this amazing letter. And in this letter, he writes that the part that you connected with this mentor, this leader, for that matter, for us, a parent or a loved one or somebody we admire, the part that you connected to was never the biological element of soul and body anyways. The part that you connected to was bigger. That bigger is what we call the ambitious level of soul. Kind of a couple levels up over here. The emotional ambition that's lives for higher purpose. And a person that we admire, those are people who we feel that they live their whole life that way. And if you think about it, when they die, we don't need the interface
yes.
and filter of their physicality anymore. We're able to immediately connect to what they were about the whole time.
Yes.
That's truly living with somebody. You're able to live with them on a higher level than
whether
you were.
Whether they're here physically or not.
Well, you're living with them. You're actually living higher than when they were physically.
Oh,
because
yes,
you're
of course.
Only living the parts of themselves that matter.
Yes.
Only the parts of themselves that inspired you.
Yes.
Only the parts of themselves that are telling you now is your time to affect this world around you.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this with me.
My pleasure.
I've never spoken to you or your wife, actually, where I haven't learned something and then been in tears from what I've seen. You're an exceptional man. Thank you, dear.
I would like to just say, I have to say it on Love Letters Live, is that I feel the same way about you.
Oh, thank you.
All the time.
Thank you. And I was just wondering, you know, how are we going to, usually I like to get to some aspect of the importance of a letter, but you ended with it because you said you wrote a letter to...
I'm actually going to add one more.
Please.
One more letter before we go.
Do it.
Can I indulge you once more a second?
Yes.
So my great-grandfather, my mom's grandfather and grandmother were a rabbi and rebbetzin in Sweden during World War II. And during World War II, they did well in Sweden as far as their work available. All the people who were coming from war-torn Europe, they were able to facilitate them. They did an amazing amount of self-service. But after the war ended and people were starting to disperse, he sent a letter that he wants to go move back to New York. He sent a letter to the Rebbe who advised him to go to Sweden. He said, "What should I do now? I want my kids to marry like-minded people, and there's nobody here in Sweden." So he took a job in Roxbury, Massachusetts, and only a short time later, the story is very sad. He was murdered.
Oh my goodness.
He walked his daughter to a friend's house, and on the way back, New Year's Eve, maybe a few drunks, an unsolved murder in the Boston area, and he died. About a year later, his wife, in depression and other things, also passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my grandmother was married already and had somebody to lean on, and I'm sure it was beyond difficult. He was a magical figure, and the mom was such a special lady. But her sister, who was single, was very much struggling and reached out to Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson for support. And he sent her the most wonderful letter to talk about this. And I actually have the letter here just to read just a little part of it.
Please.
And we'll end with that, if that's all right.
Yes, it's perfect. It's more than all right.
It's more than all right?
Okay, yes.
Great. So I always think about this as my great aunt Hannah Sharfstein, and this is the letter she got.
Okay.
And he wrote like this: "I received your undated letters in which you write about your emotional upset in connection with the passing of your mother and the questions which are troubling you in this connection, involving also questions in regard to the passing of your father, peace unto them. Another fundamental point to remember, which has a direct bearing on your letter, is that all believers in God believe also in the survival of soul. Actually, this principle has been discovered in the physical world, where science now holds as an absolute truth that nothing in the physical world can be absolutely destroyed. How much more so in the spiritual world, especially in the case of soul, which in no way can be affected by the death and disintegration of the physical body. It would be silly and illogical to assume that because a certain organ of the body ceases to function, affecting other physical organs of the body, that the spiritual soul would also be affected. The truth is that when the physical body ceases to function, the soul continues to exist not only as before, but even on a higher level, and as much as is no longer handicapped by the restraints of the physical frame.
Thank you. All right,
and
I'm going to
sum it up.
I'm just going to tell you goodbye, and will you come back and talk about something else some other time?
Anytime.
Thank you, dear. Just for now, this is Janet Gallen saying, talk to you later. Bye.